KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. More than 100 U.S. colleges and universities will require students to get vaccinated before they return to campus. The University of New Mexico recently announced it is considering such a policy, but right now, that's not the case at New Mexico State University. In depth, here's KRWG public media scholar Sarah Rodriguez.
Universities all over the United States are requiring students to receive COVID-19 vaccinations as campuses return to in-person instruction this fall. In an April 6th President's Town Hall, New Mexico State University Executive Director of Health and Wellness, Lori McKee, stated that NMSU will not be requiring students and faculty to receive or show proof of vaccination.
So no, the vaccine is currently under emergency use authorization, which means it's only been approved for emergency use. So at this point, there is no entity that can truly require you to be vaccinated, and NMSU is one of those. But we do strongly encourage.
NMSU President Dr. John Flores states that NMSU is strongly encouraging students and faculty to receive the vaccine as the campus prepares for a conventional fall semester.
We have been very straightforward and very clear from the get-go that not only we encourage people to get vaccinated, but we would like everybody to get vaccinated. This is the way that we can come back in a safe way, particularly within our campus, within our system, within our community.
In a poll conducted by the Office of the President, 93% of NMSU faculty and students claimed that they wanted to receive the vaccine, were strongly considering receiving the vaccine, or have already received it.
Only 7% of you said, no, we're not going to take the vaccine. I would very much like to make that 7% even smaller, maybe 5, maybe 2. But we can't force everybody to get vaccinated. We know that not everybody can get vaccinated, but we're going to do our best to encourage and to really guide all of you to get vaccinated now that the vaccines are widely available.
NMSU's Aggie Health and Wellness Center has been approved as a vaccine distribution site. McKee says this provides more resources for students and faculty to receive the vaccine.
There's many opportunities. So if you want a vaccination, sign up, and you will get one. We will be advertising more going through clinics during the summer. As freshmen come to campus, if they've already been enrolled, we hope to have opportunities where they can make appointments to get vaccinated if they haven't done so in their home communities.
NMSU freshman Kayla Wilson says the COVID vaccine should be required for students on campus.
I do think that students should be required to get the vaccine because, you know, all of those students that aren't vaccinated would still be at really high risks of getting COVID. And that would mean that the campus doesn't have herd immunity. So that could mean like COVID could be more widely spread if not everyone is vaccinated.
NMSU student Grace Gossett also says the vaccine should be required in the future.
As kids, we had to get vaccinated to go to school. And so I think the same should apply for the COVID-19 shot. At some point in the future, it should be required because it is such a deadly virus and it spreads very, very quickly.
Gossett says vaccinations will lead to a safer campus for students and faculty.
It helps us stay healthy and it'll help minimize the spread of the virus. And I think that's the most important, especially with the faculty and just mainly the students on campus, and it helps us get back to normal.
The COVID vaccine is available in New Mexico for everyone ages 16 and up. Register at cvvaccine.nmhealth.org and find a vaccine site near you. For KRWG Public Media, I'm Sarah Rodriguez.
Well, New Mexico counties have been seeing vaccination rates at or above national averages. But many areas in our vast region have unfilled vaccination appointments. Some folks simply aren't interested. The Mountain West News Bureau's Maggie Mullen reports.
It's a Monday in Casper, Wyoming. I'm standing inside what was once a Macy's store in a shopping mall. There's lots of mirrors, the old beauty department counter, and what used to be changing rooms. But now, this is a well-oiled pandemic-fighting machine, but with no customers.
If you just are out doing your thing and think, well, I have a spare 30 minutes, I could go get my vaccine, come on down, we're happy to do it.
That's Haley Bloom with the Casper-Natrona County Health Department. When the agency converted this building into a COVID-19 vaccine clinic, they estimated it would be capable of vaccinating up to 1,500 people a day.
We've never had more than probably 800 to 900. A typical day has been around 200 to 400.
Demand has slowed down. So much so, the department had to ask the state to halt their vaccine shipments earlier in April because they were sitting on a surplus of 20,000 shots. Nonetheless, Bloom seems optimistic, or at least playing it cool in order to create the kind of environment where people can be honest about their vaccine fears.
So if someone comes and they're unsure, they have questions, we're happy to chat with them, send a nurse over to chat with them, whatever it takes. And, you know, if it's not the right time, no one says that you can't walk out and think about it some more and come back next week.
Mark Dowell admits it's difficult to stay cool.
It makes you very frustrated. You try not to get mad.
Dowell is the Natrona County Health Officer and an infectious disease expert. He says it's also difficult dealing with the amount of misinformation that's discouraging people from getting the shot.
You try to stay even keel so you can serve the people that have put you in the position.
More than 32% of the population in Natrona County are thought to be vaccine hesitant, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. That's one of the highest percentages in the country. Take Connie Anthony, for example. I spoke to her outside the public library in Casper.
I choose not to get vaccinated. I just don't have that much trust in government vaccines and such. I don't want anything injected into my body that just hasn't been thoroughly researched, and so, no.
All vaccines go through clinical trials to test safety and effectiveness, and long-term side effects after any vaccination are extremely rare. But that's not what worries someone like Dale Godleys. There's been just 33 new cases in Natrona County over the past 2 weeks, so he doesn't think getting vaccinated is necessary.
Well, I firmly believe that I'm immune to it, so I wouldn't bother getting one.
When it comes to vaccine hesitancy, politics may be playing a part here in Natrona County, which voted overwhelmingly to re-elect former President Donald Trump. But the health department is mostly encountering people with concerns about safety and side effects. That was the case for Casper resident Brittany Braddis. I spoke to her on the phone.
I didn't want to get the shot because I didn't want to get sick, because all these people I hear are just getting so sick.
At the same time, Braddis has been really worried about getting the virus. She has severe asthma, plus she deals with the public since she and her husband own a butcher shop together. And like so many, she turned to social media to get more information. She wanted to hear from the people she already knows, so she posted on Facebook.
I just wanted to know what friends of mine have gotten the shot and what happened to them. Like, how many people got sick, how many people didn't, you know what I mean?
She got 135 responses, and they ran the gamut. Some people really discouraged Braddis from getting the vaccine, while others reassured her that it was the right choice to make.
But then people getting in fights with each other, it's so dumb.
Ultimately, the vaccine won out, partly because of what her friends working in healthcare told her, but also it was simply convenient. When she took her mom to the health department to get vaccinated, she asked the nurse if she could get one too.
So I just did it, and guess what? I got Pfizer, and I was completely fine with both shots.
Braddis's experience reflects what many public health experts are saying about this point in the vaccine rollout. Most of those in our region that were willing or eager to get vaccinated have done so. It's now down to the folks that are on the fence. Shonda Schrader is a rural health expert. She says people that are hesitant don't want to hear from the government or even scientists.
They want to hear from someone they trust. They need to know that it's safe and effective, and they need to be able to ask those questions in a safe space.
Schrader says those one-on-one conversations will be critical for helping people make informed decisions. And when they do decide they're ready, she says a shot also needs to be at the ready. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Maggie Mullen.
The Mountain West News Bureau is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The U.S.-Mexico border remains closed to most migrants and asylum seekers under a public health order. Mexico has stopped taking back families with very young children. Some of those families are released in the U.S. to pursue asylum. But the U.S. government has been flying others to different border cities, including El Paso, before expelling people into Mexico. As KERA's Mallory Falk reports from Juarez, that is straining local shelters with no clear end in sight.
The Ponte Vida Migrant Shelter sits just a few miles across the border from El Paso. It's made up of several small houses encircling a dusty courtyard. One larger building's been turned into a makeshift quarantine space. Blue sleeping pads line the floor. A few kids kick a ball back and forth, trying to avoid napping families. Several moms chop vegetables in the kitchen, making chicken soup for those who've just arrived. A Honduran father named Huver cradles his infant daughter, stroking the wisps of her soft brown hair. Ismael Martinez runs this shelter.
La mayoría de gente ha sido retornada, o sea, las han agarrado por McAllen.
Martinez says most of the families who arrived recently were flown here from South Texas, like Huver, who asked us not to use his full name because of his uncertain immigration status. He's still trying to understand what happened.
Nos traían para acá, nosotros lo imaginamos y dijimos, va, nos van a regresar a México.
Huver was stunned when officials returned his family to Mexico. Right now, Ponte Vida can hold around 300 people. Capacity is limited because of COVID-19 precautions. But Ismael Martinez has done his best to take people in. Some of the long-term residents are slowly entering the U.S. as the government unwinds a different Trump-era policy. And that's freed up some space.
Están partiendo gente para el MPP, están yendo para Estados Unidos, y están dejando espacios para la gente.
Still, more people arrive each day than Juarez's existing shelters, many of them church-run, can take in. The city recently opened a new shelter and a gym to accommodate more families.
Mexico, again, is taking the brunt of our failures.
Linda Rivas directs Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center in El Paso.
We see that by the overcrowded shelters. We see that with the fears of, you know, what if somebody had COVID during the flight and nobody's being tested?
She says shelters have scrambled to keep migrant families off the street, all while trying to reduce the risk of COVID-19. A few weeks ago, across town from Ponte Vida, Pastor Juan Fierro pointed out the makeshift quarantine space at his shelter, El Buen Samaritano. At that time, El Buen Samaritano was crowded, and Fierro was stretched thin, taking in expelled families, mostly mothers with children between 1 and 8 years old. But now, that new shelter in the gym has relieved some of the pressure on Fierro. Still, it's been hard to counsel families because there's no clear guidance on what will happen next.
No tenemos un tiempo así como para decirles a los migrantes, ¿sabes qué? Tienes que esperar un mes, ¿sabes qué? 2 meses, 3 meses.
There is no timeline he can give, like, you know what, you have to wait a month, 2 months, 3, and then you'll have a chance to ask for asylum. Fierro says that uncertainty led to a sort of revolving door at the shelter. While some families finished their quarantine and chose to stay at the shelter, others left soon after they arrived.
Pero mira.
Fierro flipped through the basic health charts for each new resident. They included people's temperatures and daily conditions.
Vamos acá, mira.
He noted just how many people had moved on.
Ya se fue. Ya se fue.
He suspects some left to try crossing the border again, hoping their second or third time across would be successful. Again, Linda Rivas.
If a person wants to come to the United States right now, the only chance that they have is to maybe go through Reynosa and be one of the lucky ones that doesn't get expelled. And that's not an asylum system.
Some families have returned to their home countries, but others plan to wait things out in Juarez, hoping a policy change gives them back something they're legally entitled to, the chance to request asylum. I'm Mallory Falk in Juarez.
Another border story now. The ACLU and the Deported Veterans Support House in Tijuana have launched a campaign urging the Biden administration to bring home deported veterans. They served in the United States military only to be later exiled from the country. Texas Public Radio's Carson Frame has more.
They came to the U.S. as children with their families and as legal permanent residents. As adults, they joined the military with the promise of a speedy path to citizenship, which never happened. After serving, they got in trouble with the law, a common occurrence for veterans coming home from war. But because they weren't naturalized citizens, many were deported for their crimes. Now those veterans want to return to the country they served and get medical care from the U.S. government.
We believe we have an ally in the White House who can stop the deportation of veterans and bring our heroes home.
Hector Barajas is an honorably discharged Army veteran who was deported. He founded the Deported Veterans Support House, which provides housing, social services, and legal resources for veterans. Veteran deportations accelerated under the Trump administration, according to Margaret Stock, an immigration attorney. She says Biden has the power to stop them from happening.
Right now, the administration can act by granting parole, by stopping the deportation of vets, by stopping the wrongful denials of military, and finally, by stopping the current practice of putting military members into deportation proceedings in the first place.
DHS did not immediately respond to questions about whether it would reinstate or improve military naturalization services in cooperation with the Pentagon. President Biden pledged to bring deported veterans home while on the campaign trail. I'm Carson Freeman, San Antonio.
KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Great to be with you. We turn to a hopeful story now. Two New Mexico State University students are using a film project to raise money for Camp Hope in Las Cruces, a community for people experiencing homelessness. The fundraiser ended this week, and I talked with Samantha D'Amico and Fernando Rivera about their project. Rivera says the idea began with a trip to another city.
It actually started about a year and a half ago when I planned to take a trip to Austin, Texas with a couple of friends. And when I think of Austin, you think of the city, you think of the grassy fields around there. And going into the actual city, it was something different from what I expected. What I saw and what I noticed was the issue of homelessness. The population was just immense around the city. It wasn't what I expected. And I thought to myself, what was going on? What was something that we can do ourselves to go ahead and help what the issue is? And so I brought that knowledge back with me. And coming into Alana's class, the social impact of film, I thought maybe this is the chance for me to actually create a difference within starting small within our community in Las Cruces, in our area, El Paso, this entire area. And many people dismiss the fact of homelessness, the issue, and only see it as a problem and not something that we can help with. And so I thought of using that time within this class to actually start something to create a difference is what made me more impactful on the issue. It helped me bring out my ideas to begin something that can actually help the community.
Yeah.
So starting small and building our way up, maybe starting small just on this little donation fundraiser, I thought it could maybe help make a difference within the community, within Las Cruces, hopefully the state, the United States, and just keep building our way up there. And using film in conjunction with this project, it only helps show the emotion of those residents at Camp Hope. It helps us show what is really going on instead of just an article reading, other people looking on the internet, what's going on. They can actually see the issue of what is happening in the community. And I thought that in the film coming together, it was perfect. Just perfect to bring up.
It really was. It really raises awareness on this issue, and getting that personal angle is so important. Samantha, I understand you really connected to this idea in that meeting some of the residents of Camp Hope changed your preconceived notions about homelessness.
Absolutely. Going into the camp, I had read about it. I had learned a little bit about it just to research in order to be on the team. But getting to meet them was such a different experience because I learned that there's so many people from different walks of life that are experiencing homelessness for different reasons. And it just gave me so much more compassion. There's people who are just had a bad home life and they're trying to get out and they're young and they're making something for themselves. Or there's someone who's in an elderly age and they're not getting enough support from the state and they're trying to survive on the streets later in life. And yeah, it just gave me so much more compassion and understanding for those around me. And it's made me much more perceptive to what's going on and how to help those around me and help those in our community.
Yeah, and the numbers are very big. You know, the federal government tracks this, and the Housing and Urban Development Department, the last number I was able to pick up was in 2019, where it said that more than 500,000 people in the United States on any given night are homeless. It's a shocking statistic. Fernando, tell me what you wanted to convey with the film for people who really were not familiar with Camp Hope or homelessness in general.
Yeah, so again, using the film idea, it helped me give that idea of what Camp Hope actually was. I would go up to certain smaller businesses or certain individuals that I knew, and I asked them, do you know what Camp Hope is? Do you know what Mesilla Valley Community of Hope is? And they were oblivious to what it was. So using this film, it gave others an idea of what we have going on within our community, that we have that help, we have that hope in here in Las Cruces. And because they were so unaware of what was going on in Camp Hope, we used the film as a sort of tool to help us. And using that film, it not only gives them the insight to see what's actually happening at Camp Hope, it lets them see the emotion, it lets them see those feelings that they are feeling, and it lets them see those residents in person and actually have a more personal connection with those people in Camp Hope.
You can watch that entire interview and the student's film about Camp Hope on the Newsmakers page in the local TV section at krwg.org. It also airs tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV. The Las Cruces City Council met in a work session this week to discuss the city's new police auditing contract, as well as hear from the City Art Board. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Members of the Police Auditing Group, OIR, introduced themselves to the Las Cruces City Council during a recent work session. The council approved a contract with the auditing company, which will report findings on a semi-annual basis in February. Councilor Gabe Vasquez says he hopes that OIR will identify complaint trends and develop a clear narrative so that action steps can be taken when necessary.
In our previous relationship with our police auditor, the presentations to council, I would say, left a little bit to be desired in terms of identifying the trends of just the types of complaints and whether they were substantiated or unsubstantiated.
OIR's Michael Janaco says he hopes the new contract brings increased transparency for both city staff and the general public.
We hope to have a more robust feedback loop to you all to identify trends and also to tell the story about what it is that we're seeing. You know, what kind, I think we can tell the story without violating any confidentiality, as long as we don't name the officers, and just give you a better understanding of what it is that is being alleged by your community, what it is that's getting into the system.
An independent police auditor has not held a contract with the city since 2019. Councilor Cassandra Gondra encouraged OIR to review complaints made during the gap between contracts.
I'd like to advocate for that gap year and a half, maybe 2 years, that, you know, some reports be sent to you, if not all, to really get an idea of, you know, where we're at. I would say that you could, you know, hit the ground running by reviewing those past cases.
The council also received an update from the City Art Board that highlighted some of the ongoing projects. One such project includes rotating temporary art installations on transit bus shelters, something Councilor Gabe Vasquez supports.
I'm especially excited about things like the rotating artwork on the bus stops that could tell a QR code story. I think that's the kind of innovation in public art that I like to see, right? Because it goes beyond something at a bus stop to an actual storytelling feature that someone can pull up on their phone. And I think that really just enriches what this like two-dimensional art can actually do.
Councilor Tessa Beta-Stuvey asked that District 2 be considered for future projects, noting that the district has had few opportunities.
There is not a ton of opportunities listed here in District 2. And so this is more for my fellow counselors. We had this issue coming up with parks as well. There haven't been any new items for District 2. It seems like this with the public art. And I just want to make a bit of an ask for consideration for that equity, especially since our district is one of our aging infrastructure areas.
Art Board member Saul Ramirez says that continuing to cultivate relationships with local artists should be a priority for the city, and that communicating how to get involved is vital.
As the city moves along and does its things and makes its choices for art, artists aren't fully aware and aren't fully plugged into those processes. And so it is often very specific people who get the chance to apply. Usually artists who already have training in that kind of grant writing and that sort of application thing, which is actually is a skill that not every artist is going to have. And I don't think every artist should have it to have that chance.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
To state politics now and legislation to rein in interest rates on so-called payday loans in New Mexico failed during the legislative session. It's not the first time. Anthony Moreno talked with Think New Mexico founder and executive director Fred Nathan about this issue. His organization was working with state lawmakers on a bill to lower the maximum annual interest rate on small loans from 175% to 36%. Here's part of their conversation.
Fred, thank you so much for joining us.
Anthony, thank you for having me.
Let's talk about understanding the need for fair lending in New Mexico. This is an issue your group has been working on for a while, and in this legislative session, I believe, it was Senate Bill 66. Now, this bill aimed to reduce the state's maximum interest rate on small loans from 175% to 36%. This stalled. Can you kind of share us your thoughts on this bill and why it was needed?
Many people may not realize what an enormous part of our economy the small loan industry is. Last year, over $660 million of loans were made $10,000 and less, and usually at a very high rate of interest. 175, which is what our state allows, is, depending on how you measure it, either the first or the third highest rate in the country. And during the pandemic, people are even more desperate for these loans. So we thought it was particularly urgent to try to address this issue and bring the rate down. Some of your viewers may know that at the federal level, the Congress has passed the Military Fair Lending Act to bring the rate down to 36% for military service people and their immediate families. After that happened, many states moved their rates down to 36%, and we just thought it was important to try to get that done this year. The Senate did pass our bill, 25-14. It got bogged down in the House Judiciary Committee and then on the House side, and we weren't able to resurrect it and get it. They changed it and made it
95%. There was an amendment, There was an amendment to, I guess, increase the interest rate, is that correct, in the House side?
Yes, and I also wanted to say, you know, the best thing about working on this bill was Senator Bill Soles from Las Cruces, who was our prime sponsor, and he was really a dedicated public servant, and he did everything he could to try to fix the bill. The bill actually went to a conference committee, and he was chairing the Senate side of that. The House members refused to meet in the conference committee, and we were hoping that we could work out some sort of compromise. And the Senate was just faced with a 99% rate, take it or leave it, which too many senators just found unconscionable for a small loan to low-income New Mexicans. And so the bill died. But I'm optimistic that we can get this done next year. The governor supports the bill, and we expect that it will be on the agenda in next year's 30-day session that will pass it.
You know, folks may not be able to go to a bank to be able to get a loan, and they turn to some of these so-called payday lenders. Is there something more that we need to address with our financial system here in our state to help address this issue?
Well, this was the argument in part that the lobbyists made for the industry, and they said if Think New Mexico and Senator Soles are successful in bringing the rate down to 36%, our industry will leave and there'll be no one to make these loans to low-income New Mexicans. But that was contradicted by the testimony from the credit unions. The credit unions historically were created by business people who were trying to protect their employees from loan sharks. So we've sort of come full circle. And their CEOs testified that there's 142 credit union branches all through New Mexico who are already making these small loans profitably and for less than 36%. And so their argument to the legislature, which I thought was very compelling, was if this industry were to leave the state, we're more than happy to pick up that market share and we can make these loans profitably for less than 36%. So that's really the answer, is we can make credit in New Mexico both safe, affordable, and also accessible to every New Mexican who needs a small loan.
Fred Nathan is founder and executive director of Think New Mexico. Fred, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program.
And Anthony, thank you so much for having me on your show.
And you can watch that entire interview on the Fronteras page in the local TV section at krwg.org. A new survey from the Episcopal Health Foundation shows 49% of Texans, yeah, almost half, say it's difficult for them and their family to afford medical care. Here's Roz Brown from the Texas News Service.
For the third year, the foundation's chief communications officer, Brian Sasser, says the survey shows more than half of all Texans say they aren't keeping up with their health care needs because it costs too much. He adds those who are uninsured report an even tougher time paying medical bills or even accessing basic health services.
When you see so many people skipping or postponing care, not filling prescriptions, there we're not talking about huge medical bills from some complex surgery. We're talking about the checkups and routine visits.
Texas has more uninsured people than any other state, including workers with jobs at grocery stores, childcare centers, and construction sites. I'm Roz Brown.
KRWG News This Week, I'm Fred Martino. What a week it has been. Republicans dumped Representative Liz Cheney from her House leadership post. The reason? Her persistent repudiation of President Donald Trump's election falsehoods. But the Wyoming Republican is defiantly insisting she will keep trying to wrench her party away from the former president and his, quote, destructive lies. GOP lawmakers needed less than 20 minutes and a voice vote to remove Cheney from her job as their number three House leader. The move was pushed by Trump and other top Republicans, and it underscores the hold the twice-impeached former president retains on his party and his ability to upend the careers of antagonists. Some of the harshest critics are those who often align themselves with the GOP. Columnist Peter Werner in the New York Times wrote, quote, "Today the Republican Party is less a political party than a political freak show. It is being sustained by insidious lies. And people who love America, starting with conservatives, should say so. Otherwise, if the Republican Party's downward spiral isn't reversed, it will descend even further into a frightening world of illusion." Well, many people are talking about the divisions in the Republican Party following last year's elections, including commentator Peter Goodman.
Thoughtful Republicans are in a tough spot. They don't cotton to Joe Biden's rainbow administration or big stimulus and infrastructure plans, but they love our country. Having helped evict Donald Trump, they'd like to resume their traditional Republicanism. But Trump has declared war on our democracy. Some folks will follow him over any cliff, or go over the cliff he points them at, saying he'll join them. Many Republican politicians are choosing Trump over democracy. Some may believe Trump. Ambitious clowns like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley figure Trump won't last that long, and they can reap the political capital he's banking. Anyone who doesn't join him, like Representatives Liz Cheney and Anthony Gonzalez, Trump wants to choke the political life out of. Cheney won't join Trump's anti-democratic movement. She recalls that Trump's false claim of election theft provoked violence on January 6th. All the courts rejected Trump's election fraud claims. Trump himself has never articulated how some massive multi-state conspiracy occurred. But he's repeating the lie, knowing it could provoke violence again. And it is. Already, Arizona's Republican Secretary of State has to have armed guards protecting her. Cheney says Trump is forcing Republicans to choose between his lies and, quote, truth and fidelity to the Constitution. He is, but obviously, kneeling to Trump and the base won't increase the Republican Party's overall popularity. Most folks know the election theft claim is silly. They also honor John McCain as a war hero and prefer George Washington to Vladimir Putin. A prominent Republican pollster consultant says Trump's a massive favorite to win the 2024 Republican nomination, but a massive underdog to Biden. To improve their odds, Republican-controlled states are making Trump's lies their excuse for changing the election process to guarantee a Trump win in 2024, no matter what their state's voters want. All studies show voter fraud is almost non-existent, but Republicans in swing states are passing dangerous laws that will minimize voter turnout, particularly in progressive cities. Georgia's law even lets Republican legislators toss out county voting boards that certify honest counts the legislators didn't like. In 2020, when Trump told the Georgia Secretary of State, "Find me 11,000 more votes," the man said, "No, sir." In 2024, the Secretary of State won't even have a say. The Republican politicians, who do, may go right along with the Republican presidential nominee. Many countries have lost their democracies to dictators because rich folks and ideological allies of the authoritarian thought they could use or control the would-be dictator. Cheney is choosing democracy over blind Trumpism. But too many Republican lawmakers are making the wrong choice. Each Republican voter has a decision to make.
Peter Goodman's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. In focus now, what everyone seems to be talking about, especially in Washington, the economy. Where is it going? Some hopeful news. Recent data shows the gross national product, or GDP, is back to pre-pandemic levels. We talked about this and much more with New Mexico State University economist Dr. Chris Erickson.
Well, our GDP is almost exactly the same as it was previously. We still have about 8% fewer workers in the workforce than we had prior to the pandemic. That means you've had the same GDP with 8% fewer workers. That's a tremendous increase in productivity. And a lot of that increase in productivity has been driven by the fact that businesses have been forced to adopt new technologies to cope with the pandemic. For example, you and I are talking on Zoom. Probably many people who are listening to this are familiar with Zoom now and have been using Zoom and never used Zoom prior to the pandemic. And so the economy is coming back, roaring back. We also, of course, have a very low interest rates, very aggressive monetary policy, and that also is contributing to our rapid recovery. Now, as the stimulus, I'm going to call it the Trump stimulus because it was passed during the Trump administration, but as this Trump stimulus moves into the economy and begins to, it already is affecting our economy now, already is moving into the economy, but as it plays out, that's when Biden's American Rescue Plan will kick in and should give us that push to get us over the edge and to the next level. if we have this, again, it's a tremendous increase in productivity that we're observing right now. If we can sustain that increase and put people back to work, and I think that's what the Biden, I'm going to call it the Biden plan now to distinguish it from what Trump had done previously. If what Biden has been passed under the Biden administration, that should allow us to get everybody back to work. And if we can maintain this very dramatic increase in productivity, it's a very positive, potentially a very positive outcome for the country.
Yeah, so very interesting. I've got to ask you real quickly before we move on, are you worried about inflation as a result?
Well, of course, that's the negative of all this. We have a lot of stimulus, monetary policy, very low interest rates. We have a very rapid increase in the monetary base. We have these three very, very large stimulus plans that have come through, 200 Trump and 100 Biden. And of course, the inflation in April on an annualized basis was 10%. That's 0.8% for the month. But if you analyze that, 0.8% for 1 month comes out to the equivalent of 10% per year. That's very rapid inflation. It's the most rapid inflation since 2008. And now it's coming off of a low base, because if you look back in April of 2020, that was at the very peak of the recession, of the pandemic recession, and we had very low inflation back then. The question is, will this inflation be sustained? And probably not. We've got a long time of very low inflation, and I anticipate that continuing into the future.
That's good news. Really good news to hear that, and that your perspective on that, because more money is going to be pumped into the economy. A lot more money. There is a nice chunk of state and local aid in the Biden plan, $350 billion, but it has to be spent by the end of 2024. Some states looking at really targeted things like shoring up unemployment benefits. Others are looking at long-term priorities needed even before the pandemic, like infrastructure. Your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's all of the above. Of course, right now our unemployment insurance program is in deficit and will need more funding, and should receive that funding, because unemployment insurance has been a bulwark of this recovery, providing funds to the people who really need it. And on a humanitarian basis, that's important, because we want families to be able to feed and clothe themselves and pay their rent. But on an in terms of the macro economy, it's people who are unemployment who, when they receive aid, spend it, whereas other people have jobs, if they receive aid, for example, stimulus checks, they tend to save those more rather than spend it. And so getting money to the people who are the most impacted is the way to get that money back into the economy working as quickly as possible. So both from a policy perspective and again from a humanitarian perspective, unemployment insurance is important, and we need to fund that.
Yeah, but you say that it is wise to also look at other things that are more long-term, like infrastructure. That's interesting. It actually hasn't gotten a lot of press. Another thing that really hasn't gotten much press either, I was surprised when I was researching to do this show, that President Biden's plan said that stimulus dollars could not be used directly or indirectly to finance tax cuts. And as a result, Republicans have filed a lawsuit saying that that's an unconstitutional mandate. Do you think, as an economist, not looking at this politically, but looking at it as an economist, do you think tax cuts are even a good consideration for this money?
Well, no. The better consideration is to provide checks to people who are low income. Of course, the plan already does that.
Yeah.
Now, I will tell you that's sort of a tax cut. When you give funds to people, it's sort of a tax cut, and you're not actually cutting their taxes, but you are giving them money back, so their disposable income goes up. But again, targeting people who are low income, who may not actually be paying taxes, or at least not much taxes, are the group who would benefit most from, or I should say, who the colony would benefit most from receiving those funds. And it's just the common sense idea that poor people are not in a position to save as much or even save at all compared to middle class and upper middle class and wealthy people.
Sure, and they've been hurting long before the pandemic as well. There's an argument in New Mexico over this, as you know, the governor vetoing some federal relief allocations made by the legislature. The courts will have to sort that out. How do you think New Mexico should spend this federal funding? Is it different than the average state?
Well, we have a tremendous shortfall. We have a tremendous shortfall in broadband. We're one of the states that are performing the worst in broadband when you make comparisons. That's access by households, access that one of the really crazy things is even those households who have access to broadband are much less likely in New Mexico to have access to two providers, which means they're forced to pay. They generally will pay higher rates or have poor service because of a lack of competition, and so I think that there's a tremendous need for broadband. And of course, the last state legislature, they passed a lot of funding for broadband compared to previous legislatures. So there's been forward motion on broadband. And I hope that the governor decides to use the federal funding for broadband.
Well, and of course, which, Chris, by the way, there may even be more money for broadband if an infrastructure bill can be passed. As you know, the Biden administration, that's a major priority. Advocates say that this is an ideal time. A lot of work is needed. Interest rates are relatively low, extremely low, actually, zero. Public support is very high for this as well. What are your thoughts on this? Because this is, an enormous plan. It's unlikely probably to pass in its current form, but what are your thoughts about doing this at this time after all of these other stimulus plans?
Well, so one of the things I really want to emphasize here is that people for political reasons, both on the Democrat side and the Republican side, are touting this as this huge expenditure on infrastructure. When you work it out over 10 years, and remember this infrastructure bill we're talking about is over 10 years of spending, it's not really that large an increase in infrastructure spending. In fact, there are many analysts, and by many analysts I mean me, who think that it should be larger.
Yeah.
It should be larger. Not
yeah,
smaller.
Well, I guess, you know, this is interesting, and context is really important. We don't get that in the 10-second sound bites. I was thinking about it in those terms, too, that, you know, the plan is about $2 trillion, and we spend that on defense in a couple of years. In three
exactly.
years, we spend more than
exactly.
that. So, well, you know, Chris, Republicans are balking at the idea of tax hikes to pay for the plan. President Biden says, you know, the rich need to pay their share, and the corporate tax hike under his plan would still mean that the corporate tax rate would be lower than before the Trump tax cuts, which mostly benefited the corporations and the wealthy. Your thoughts on this?
Well, I think that if you finance with deficit spending, because I'm not a big deficit hawk, and I think funding this with deficit spending is okay. I think raising taxes, you point out, the increase of taxes is not excessive, and that's okay too. What's not okay is not doing. And so we need to figure out some way to pass this bill. And if that means funding of deficits rather than raising taxes, I don't think that's a terrible idea. We really have a lot of infrastructure shortfalls in our country. We spend less on infrastructure than Europe does, less on infrastructure than Japan does. Now, we also spend less than China does, but China is starting at a very low base, so it's not really apples to apples when you compare us to China.
Well, Chris, this is so interesting. I'm running out of time, and I don't want to miss this next question because it's been overshadowed by federal news. Speaking of taxes, once again, the New Mexico legislature failed to address comprehensive gross receipts tax reform in the last legislative session. What are your thoughts about this? We've talked about this for 13 years.
Yes, I think the gross receipts tax in New Mexico is one of the things that holds our state back from growing, because it does penalize, often penalize, manufacturing and wholesaling. And if we could fix it so it didn't do that, it would be an improvement. So that what's referred to often as pyramiding needs to be taken care of. If it were up to me, I would go to a value-added tax, which is what's used in Europe, what's used in Australia, and used in many countries around the world. And the value-added tax would eliminate or replace the gross receipts tax. It would replace the income tax on personal income. It would increase. It would replace the income tax on corporations. And that one unified tax rate on all activity would go a long ways towards making our state more competitive. I'm not holding my breath that my ideas will be adopted. So it from a more realistic point of view, if they can fix the Swiss cheese of a tax, gross receipts tax that we have, make it more simple, make it more straightforward, and make sure that manufacturers and wholesalers don't have to pay it on goods and services that they buy within the state, I think that would be helpful. But as I said, going to a real value-added tax would be even better.
Okay, 2 minutes left. It took a special session, but the legislature did pass cannabis legalization. Some think this could be a boon for southern New Mexico. And if you look at southern Colorado, you'd think they're right. Tiny Trinidad, Colorado is 15 miles from the New Mexico border. It has boomed from cannabis. As one example, there are close to 30 dispensaries in this little town. Your thoughts?
Yeah, cross out the word, cross out the Trinidad and put in Anthony, New Mexico. I think you have the story pretty well already written of what's going to happen. And Tucum carries the same way. There are other places in the state that I think are going to benefit from this because of the change in our laws. Of course, poor Trinidad now is going to lose its customer base since New Mexico now will have legalized marijuana.
It's going to be interesting, isn't it, to see how this all develops. And sales are expected to start next spring. Interestingly enough, legalization starts at the end of June. And so we'll have to watch and wait. I bet you and I could probably, a year from now, do a whole show on this, Chris.
Oh, yeah. And I will say one last comment is I think that the proponents of cannabis legalization probably overstate the benefits, and the opponents overstate the costs. I, of course, favor cannabis legalization because of a civil libertarian point of view on the issue. But it will definitely be a boom for Anthony and Tucumcari and other towns like that.
The border towns. It's always interesting talking to you. Dr. Chris Erickson from New Mexico State University. Let's do it again soon.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, and KRXG Silver City. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. The next two Saturdays, join us for Rethinking Mental Health Care, a very special series during Mental Health Awareness Month.